there's like a shelf with like all these knickknacks on it, right? And then you just
they're called art, not knickknacks.
Welcome to the yet to be titled podcast with Sarah Allen and Jason Chen. It's a podcast about making innovation work, about solving for the right problem, and doing things that have meaningful impact in software, business, and life. How you doing, Sarah?
I'm doing pretty great.
Yeah.
What a weekend we had.
Yeah, what were we up to this weekend?
So we were at the first ever hackathon at the Smithsonian Institution.
So the Smithsonian, it's founded in, 1848? 46? Something
in
like that? We'll look it up.
Mid-1800s.
Yes, and all the way now to 2013, no hackathons.
They have had edit-a-thons.
Okay.
With the Wikimedia Foundation.
Yeah, so editing Wikipedia, that's kind of like making stuff, but not quite the software.
And they have been doing crowdsourcing since the very, very first secretary.
So you put a call out for, like, animals.
No, the telegraphs.
Okay.
So they went along the railroad lines and reported in about weather across the country.
Oh, and so they were collecting the data.
They were collecting data, the crowd. The railroad operators were the crowd in the day.
Yeah.
And they were collecting data. So the Smithsonian Institution has a long history of innovation.
Well, that's for sure. But in this case, we were doing the first hackathon.
Yes.
And, we were using this API, right? This is my first time using an API to build software. So it was a big first for me. So not only
Smithsonian, but... great.
Well, thanks. My code is still not able to push to Heroku, so I'm still going to work on that. And I'm going to need you to help me debug this
later. No problem. I'm stoked.
But so what was the goal here? What was this hackathon all about?
Well, it started with the idea of doing something that was an alternative or a prerequisite, perhaps, to an RFP.
Okay.
So an RFP is this process that the government and big companies sometimes go
through. Request for proposal.
Request for proposal, where you want some software project. So you say, hey, we need a software project with these requirements. And then a bunch of contractors say, we'll do it for this much money.
It's like a big contest, like a bid process.
Yeah, exactly. And so Georgina and Diego got together, and Georgina said, hey, you're a innovation fellow. What can we put in this RFP that's going to be innovative?
Right.
And so Diego said, I think we're not ready for an RFP. We need some ideation.
And so Georgina's the head of new media at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And Sam, but I guess they're told not to.
It's just American art.
Oh, it's just American art, which is like...
at American art.
On Twitter.
On Twitter.
Which is like kind of confusing, because then you're like, American art? What, that's it? This is the one American...
the Smithsonian,
right.
American Art Museum.
But,
it's the American Art Museum.
Right. And then she had, and she's been doing a lot of, because what they had these kiosks, right? So it's for this Luce Center.
Yes, the L-U-C-E, Luce Center. Although when I first heard it, I thought it was L-O-O.
Oh, Luce. You're like, that's one way to name your...
Because they have this visible storage.
Right.
So I missed the tour that other people went on.
The first tour.
Yes. So before the Wikipedia edit-a-thon, there was a tour of the Luce Center. And somebody was telling me about it, about how they had... visible storage. So they've got these cases that they're like they are in these locked up collections buildings where they keep all the art.
Oh, that's like actually what it looks like in those.
It's a little more arranged, but basically.
Yeah.
That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
Secondhand. I might be spreading rumors.
Rumors. You heard it here first.
But they have these cases set up. And the idea is you're kind of behind the scenes in the collections.
Right.
And so when I was told it was the Luce Center, I thought, this is where the art
is like kind of just floating around and just like...
It's out there on the loose.
It turns out Luce is the name of a guy who gave a bunch of money, as most of these centers end up being.
Or a family, I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. Some set of people who have money and last names
are. And so they have Luce Foundation centers all over the place.
Right, and so then they have these kiosks, which she designed
8 years ago.
That's a long time.
They're
right?
still pretty nice.
2005, right? So these kiosks where you have like those old school touch screens before we had iPads. God, can you remember when before we had iPads? You had these things, and then I remember going to the doctor and touching those screens. And you had to push really hard. You know, that was a thing. You had to like push hard to like make it respond.
I think these are a little better than those.
Those are better than those, but you know, and then it has this menu of things. It looks like an old Windows.
Yes, but it is actually a Shockwave movie.
Oh. No, you not. They said that.
Yes, it's a Shockwave movie. It's all my fault.
Oh, you know, and for those who don't know, Sarah actually had a very critical role in making Shockwave a thing.
Yes, and it was very cool in 1995.
Boom, right. But they made it in 2005, so.
So, yeah, maybe it wasn't the best technology choice in 2005, but it was, you know, still okay. But nowadays,
right,
not so much.
And so what you could do is, like, search for art in the galleries. You could browse and see what was on exhibit. You know, they have a lot of paintings, they have crafts, they have sculptures, they have a bunch of different types of art.
Yeah, and you can see what's on exhibit, so you can go visit it, or you can see what's not on exhibit, so right. You can see it.
And they had a little scrapbook feature, which doesn't work anymore, but apparently at one point worked. You could like save, oh, this is the art that I like, and then you could email it to yourself. So,
right.
So she's like, we need to update this. It's been 8 years. It was pretty good at the time, but... And then Diego, our fellow, was kind of advising her and saying, I don't think you know enough to create a proposal.
Right, so he and Georgina came up with this idea of doing a hackathon to... Really, a ideation session. And then Diego was telling me about this, and I said, oh, we have this amazing API inside the Smithsonian that's used by all these different websites at the museum, archives, and libraries, and we should use that and really allow people to program and write code.
Because before this, they were just going to, like, sit down and do, like, a big brainstorm. Is that
what
you're saying?
Well, they have these... I've never been to this kind of a hackathon, but they have, like, through the Open Data Initiative, there's data jams where they say, we have all these really cool data sets. Just imagine what you could do with them.
Right.
And people come up with ideas.
And then they, like, work together to build it on their own time, and then they come back and do the
right,
data.
But the palooza. Event the is data pure. Jam. The yeah. data jam is purely an ideation session.
That's
so
that's interesting. Yeah.
So, but I was really excited about the idea of actually having a hackathon because I like hackathons.
Right.
And I have, ever since I found out about this amazing API that the Smithsonian has, I've wanted them to open it.
Yeah, and you saw this as an opportunity. You were pushing your agenda.
It's true.
Don't even pretend like it.
I must admit, it's not my agenda. Right. I like to think of it as the people's agenda.
That's right. All those people out there who want to use the API or who helped develop the API 8 years ago, and then it hasn't really seen the light of day outside of the organization. Right. But let's rewind a little bit, because even though I've been a fellow and we've been throwing around the word API all the time, you know, I only had sort of I always knew about APIs because of Foursquare. Because Foursquare kind of like opened up their API, and so like there are all these apps that were location aware, right? And that they could know where you were because they were using Foursquare's API to figure out where you were. Because like, and so that's how I understood what APIs were, because it's like, oh, I guess you're sending location information to Foursquare, and then Foursquare sends you back like, here's a list of like real things, like the Starbucks on whatever, or like the White House because you're near whatever, and it just knows that. Right. And that's how I knew what an API was. But then outside of, you know, I like, that's such a slice into what this thing is. So, you know, what are we starting from? Not from scratch, but starting, like, what is
an API?
Yeah.
Well, it stands for Application Programmer Interface, which basically a software application. And it's the interface between a software application and a programmer. So you have some code that's running, some database, some Something, something.
Okay.
Some kind of something, software. Something,
that's a technical term.
Exactly. So you have some software, and this is a way for programs to talk to each other.
Okay.
And this word existed long before web services. You would have C libraries with APIs that talk to other, that you would bind into your native desktop application.
But so, you know, my early programming classes, we learned about things like functions and like methods, and you'd like pass in parameters to the function. So is it like that?
So an API is basically a set of well-defined functions or methods on some, that lets you talk to some software when you don't have access to the source code.
Right. So it's so this is external to some level. Right.
I mean, it still could be all one piece of software because sometimes you have a library that's connected to it.
So what makes a what's the difference between an API and a library?
The library is a library is just a piece of code that another piece of code uses.
But isn't that what?
And so the API, you could have multiple implementations of an API. So like for a web service, so right. We are using for the hackathon, we use the EDAN API.
Right.
Which is what they call this API to the Smithsonian's data. And it has a particular implementation in a particular language. You know, it's written in Java. It's got some Lucene Solr backend. But they could completely re-implement the backend with completely different code and leave the API exactly the same.
Because the connector, like the way it's set up is... Like, all that matters, all that it needs to know is what are they asking for and how do I get, and you would sort of, like, refit your thing to, like...
Right, so when we talk about APIs these days, we're usually talking about web service APIs.
Okay.
Which means that you're talking, using the web protocol, HTTP, from one piece of software to another.
Okay.
So that means that anything that acts like a web server can respond to that API. And so it's really, you know, you could write in Java and Ruby and Python and C++.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It knows what to do.
Right. You have a bunch of open source code that lets you respond to those kind of requests.
And so the result was that we could make programs at, that accessed the data that the Smithsonian had. And EDAN, connects to all these databases within the Smithsonian, like 81 databases that are in all these different museums, right? That natural history, you know, American history, the American
and the archives and the libraries.
Right. So they, and then they're all those databases. And so that was a big piece of work to get that set up, period.
Yeah, it's a really phenomenal technology.
Okay. And then so they made that, and then, but it was always internal, right? Like, you know, we made, there's like this collections.si.edu, and that uses the API, so then you can search through Smithsonian stuff.
Exactly, and the American History Museum, if you go to their collections, you can either search just American history or across the institution.
Right.
Same with the Smithsonian Institute Archives.
So when we're talking about data, we're talking about like the image title, the who made it, the date, like what's it made out of, all this like metadata, right? This
right, a know, description of the piece sometimes, or
right,
what relevance it had, yeah, what era it was associated with,
right, impressionism or whatever,
like Civil War,
yeah, topical areas. So they have all these pieces, and so, so that was exciting because now people were making things, right? Like, so, what kind of stuff? Like, let's talk about some of the stuff that people made.
Yeah. So should we talk a little bit about what happened?
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
So we had it planned for Saturday and Sunday, starting at 9:30 Saturday morning,
yeah,
until 11 o'clock Saturday night.
That's serious.
It was serious. And then everybody was back. Well, not everybody was there at 9, but everybody could have gotten there at 9. And a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
Until everybody had to be done at 4 o'clock. So roughly 36 hours of coding.
Right.
And designing and figuring things out.
Right.
And it started with a tour of the Luce Center and really understanding what the needs of this kiosk was.
Right.
Which was pretty awesome, I have to say. I love the Luce Center.
You like the tour?
Yes.
Well, because you get to see a lot of art. You know, normally it's like you have to walk for a while before you see, you know, you see a couple things, and you like walk for a while, and then you see like three more things. This is like 20 pieces of art in like one step.
I also really like it because it's kind of, things are put together in a way that's with a little humor. Things are a little eclectic. You're more likely to be surprised.
Interesting.
Than in your typical, in the rest of the art museum.
Don't tell the curators. I bet they want, I bet they think that they're going to surprise you, but then.
Well, I think that in the museum, you have, every piece gets its own kind of big space, and there's like a nice space between the pieces, so you kind of have the opportunity to really give every piece of work its own attention.
Rather than being kind of like finding a secret almost, right? It's like this experience of like, there's like a, right? Like, so what we're talking about is like, there's like a shelf. There's like a shelf with like all these knickknacks on it, right? And then you just.
They're called art, not knickknacks.
I think.
Small sculptures, I think we would call them.
I think that, you know, if you put those in a yard sale, they'd be called knickknacks. and no one would know the difference. It's like the whole like, put Josh Brolin in the subway. No, have you seen this video where they like took this violinist who was going to play later that night in like some symphony theater and makes like $5 million a year. And they put him in a subway and like people didn't give, no one recognized, one person recognized him over like a whole day. And like he made like $20, you know, like playing, you know, things that people pay hundreds of dollars to like, months in advance to like get these tickets, and people didn't even make him $20. So presentation is everything. Yeah. Knickknacks in a flea market, but no, they are legitimate pieces of authentic American art on these shelves. But there's a lot of them, right? And sometimes they're small, and so they're all kind of all stacked together. And
like the lover's eyes. Did you see that?
Yeah. Well, we heard the story too, right? So this idea that artists were making. Getting paintings of their wives or like people that they cared about, and they'd have them in these little lockets, and you know, it's kind of like before we had photographs where we'd be like, oh, here's my kid or here's my cat. It was like, here's this painting I commissioned from this artist that goes in this small thing that I keep in my shirt pocket. But then, you know, some sleazy guys out there had their mistresses, and they're like, pay my mistress. And the painter, I mean, this is like kind of interesting because the paint, you know, they, it sounds like the painter didn't ask for permission from the person, right? Like,
no, I think the mistress probably sat for it, but they didn't want to get discovered.
Right. Well, so do you think,
I think the
painter talked to the guy and was like, hey, instead of painting your mistress's whole face, I'm just going to paint, like.
Well, I would suspect it was some kind of collusion to the first one.
Yeah.
To say, well, I really want a portrait of my mistress, but I don't want everybody to know
right.
who she is, because that would be bad.
That would be bad. So then they painted her eye, and then it's
so
like,
it's like this locket with an eye.
Right. It was pretty creepy. And then you like look at it, and then all the rich guy
became a trend.
Became a thing.
Yeah, like everybody had like, they would put it on their inside pocket or whatever.
It was like hashtags. It was like selfies.
Selfies
of the like, you know,
of the rich and famous.
Of the rich and famous in whatever era that was in. So yeah, so a lot of interesting things in the Louvre Center. And so that tour, there was that tour, people got to like play with the kiosk, and there's like these interesting ideas. Like, I don't know if this was in there, but this idea of like what's on the aisle. Did they have that? Do you remember if they had that? Like what art is in which aisle?
Yeah, because all of the art is cataloged about what's in what case.
But do you remember in the kiosk whether you could like search that way?
Oh, I think you couldn't do it in the current kiosk.
Oh, because
it
wasn't updated
that they
enough.
Wanted to do. I'm not sure.
Right.
But it was definitely something they wanted in the new kiosk.
Right. So, and then, you know, we gave this little presentation on the API.
Right. So, well, we were supposed to have lunch and then the API presentation, but everybody got to work.
And
everybody
was ready to go.
They were, like, eating while they're figuring out what they're going to do, and so we did the API talk early.
Yeah. And so what makes for a good API talk when you need to, like, explain to people the API, right? Like, is most of the work in doing the API originally?
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, I think the main thing is to get across the capabilities of the API and just pointing people to resources. I mean, the people who were writing code at the hackathon would know how to use it. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like I was teaching them the methodology. It was just showing them, okay, you can do this, that, and the other thing. And we made some really fun interactive docs using Swagger.
Right.
Which is an open source documentation framework made from Wordnik. The company Wordnik made it for their own API, and then they open sourced it.
That's sweet.
Kind of awesome.
Yeah, that's sweet. And then so how did, like, how hard is it to implement Swagger?
It is easy to implement, but hard to figure out how to implement. The documentation is kind of in many little places tucked away, and there's a lot of different options for how you might do it.
Yeah.
So it took a little while to figure out, like, I had to try, like, several things before I figured out which one of the many things that I might do.
But, like, how does it work? Like, you give it, like, the API? Like...
Well, it's really easy. So it's just some HTML.
Yeah.
That's got dynamic AJAX calls, so it's, you know, opening up things.
Okay.
You click on things, they go whoosh open, and they show more detail.
Yeah.
And you serve up, you have these JSON files. That's not JSON, as in JSON Shen.
No, not my files. Okay.
JavaScript object notation.
Right.
And so you have these files that describe your API. And they're pretty straightforward format. It just says, hey, here's the...
Is that something that comes with every API? Or is that something you had to create specifically to give it to Swagger?
It's a total Swagger-only thing.
So you had to make this.
Although there are
JSON
other
file.
Things that do similar types of things, but this format is specific to Swagger.
So you had to make that JSON file.
Right.
Okay.
So that's really easy, except the thing that's a little tricky is... I had to configure Apache so that it proxied to our server, because normally, I'm deploying the, just to develop the APIs.
Yeah.
I'm running it on localhost.
Yeah.
And the API is actually running at a Smithsonian server.
Right.
And so I can't just make an AJAX call to a Smithsonian server, because that's a cross-site scripting attack.
XSS. Yeah. That's all I know. I've seen that.
So there are ways to make it work, but those would require server changes to support JSONP or something like that.
Okay.
So what I ended up doing was that you call it proxying through a local server. So I had Apache running locally.
Yep.
And just configured it so that my HTML code is calling Apache and on my local machine, and that's calling Smithsonian.
And that was okay.
So that was pretty easy. I mean, it was, you know, once I figured out, of all the many things that I might do, that, you know, because I was like, well, should I make, like, a little Sinatra Ruby app to do it, or should I do, you know, it's often hard to decide which, when you're doing something relatively simple, but I hadn't done this particular thing before, which one of the many technologies you might use that you did use. So then it was, like, 6 lines in the config file, and it was easy.
Yeah, it's tough when you have so many abilities with technology and you're like, how could I implement this in the best way? Because I have all these technologies in my hand and just, oh, it's so hard to decide.
Well, if I'd done it before, then I would know exactly what to do.
Right, right. It's interesting how, you know, a huge part of doing anything new is overcoming this ambiguity, this hurdle of like, oh, I'm not sure. Should I start here? Should I start there? Should I wait? Or should I start now? And, you know, I think that the people who end up doing things kind of realize when there's a point where you just go, it doesn't really matter. Just do something, and then you'll find out. And you might be wrong, but whatever. And then you'll go back and fix whatever it was. But you can't let that, like, break your momentum.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing with starting things. It's just making all... You have to make 104 choices.
Right.
And those choices will determine the choices you can take next. And if you make the wrong choices, then you have to go back up.
It's like the choose your own adventure. You're like, you can't choose the wrong adventure. Don't go with the evil clown, you know? Okay, so we got the API set up. We taught, you know, people, we didn't really teach. They knew how to use it because they saw
that. So we pointed them to the resources. Yeah. We sort of walked them through the capabilities of the API.
Yeah.
And we told them about what they could and couldn't do, and then they just had
went at it.
And they were super excited, and they Some of them went back into the museum and talked to visitors.
Right. There was some design thinking, design, you know, customer interviews, things like that
there
going on.
There were stickies on the wall and drawings.
Yeah, there's definitely some drawings. And, like, you know, I was able to program. I ended up in a team with Molly Ruskin and Erie Meyer. And you know, Molly's a presidential innovation fellow with us, but she works at the VA, and she's a designer. And then Erie works at the White House in the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy. And she's amazing. You know, she's just so, like, funny and, like, has all this great stuff that she's doing.
Yeah, and when I first heard she was coming and she was going to give, say, a few words for OSTP, I thought she would come for 5 minutes and leave.
Yeah.
And she stayed for the whole hackathon.
Well, she registered before she was even in the White House. You know, she said she registered a million years ago. I don't know. She probably knew that she might be working in the White House or, like, probably in the interview phase.
We actually did not pose the hackathon a million years ago.
Oh, really? No? That wasn't accurately?
Yeah. But...
So you're saying she lied?
At the first opportunity, I'm sure she
did. So, so what happened is that I ended up being the developer for my... Right? So, like, you've been in... You know, like, you've been to a couple hackathons. I've been to, like, a startup weekend and you know, this hackathon, and usually you, like, get together in these teams, and there's usually, like, you know, one or two, you know, you need at least one developer, or else you have this, like, bogus, like, idea app.
Well, actually, my favorite app was the video by the kids. They didn't have one, they had a developer, but they didn't write any code.
Right. But the dad knew what was possible in a way that made what they were doing more legitimate.
Yeah.
And of course it helps that there are kids. but generally at these hackathons, you need someone that, where's the hacking, you know, right? But of course, you know, so it's just like I have started to learn how to program, right? And I started doing it early in 2013. And
you wrote a Rails app.
I wrote a little Rails app, little baby Rails app. But it was just so funny to be, like, looking around and being like, I guess I'm in a team of three, and I guess I'm the developer in this team.
But that's how you learn.
It was amazing. I mean, the API was very straightforward, right? Like, well, what I did is I took Diego's app and then I modified it. And that was great because he got kind of things started. Although I had to go back and, like, you know, reinstall Xcode and, like, install command line things and update Ruby, and I still can't get to the right version of Ruby, but whatever. But got my environment set up, then I was able to take his app, and then I, you know, and what he had was basically an app that you pressed a button and it just randomly loaded a new image for
you.
Yeah,
it was a great sample starter app.
Right.
Because it was super simple, very little code. But it did something that you could visually see.
It was cool.
It was fun.
Yeah, the image, like, it looked good, you know?
I think a lot of people started with that. Maybe another team. A couple teams started with that app.
It's a good starter app. And so I took it, and then I kind of, like, shrunk the image because I knew I wanted to do something for mobile, and I wanted to have, like, a search box. And so I just started, like, modifying his thing. And so that, like, made it so easy because you do the call. Like, he set up a couple things that I... you know, didn't know how to, like, I found out later there's these config files or some of the, like, you know, like, the access to the Eden API, like, the password and stuff, that's where it was put, and I was like, I didn't even see that, I didn't know where that was, but, you know, he did that, and then I could just be like, oh, I see, because the way, like, you know, the request, I guess, works is you make this object, and it's like, you know, EQ, or, like, something equals EQ dot...
Right, so I wrote a Ruby gem.
Right, because you were calling that.
Right, which was a very, very simple wrapper
right on
the API.
So that's what he's... It's like EDAN query, right?
Yep.
And then, so we use the Ruby gem to talk to the API, and then, you know, then you have this object that you can send queries to, right? There's, like, this structured, like, little... language, and you just say, like, Q equals, and then you type in your query, or you can make a variable that...
Yeah, that's one of the nice things about HTTP APIs, that you can just type in the URL and have it return something.
Right.
And most of what people were doing was to look at the art. and look at the metadata for the art.
Right.
So you ended up with these, like, really easy calls.
Except when there's spaces in your query, and then it breaks, and you have to be like, you can type whatever you want, except this space.
Because... But what I'd like to do is make a gem that does, that encapsulates all of those calls by having an object, like what Kin did. So Kin wrote the PHP connector.
Kin Lane, another presidential innovation fellow.
API evangelist. Yeah. The awesome Kin Lane.
Yes.
So he wrote one that wrapped up each thing so you could just call add tag. And you'd have a method call in PHP add tag.
Wait, what add tag?
There was a tag service.
Okay.
So you could add a tag, remove a tag, so forth.
I see.
So the, like, a nicer wrapper.
Add tag to the image or add tag into the query?
Add tag to the record.
Okay, so like a tag.
You'd have, instead of having something where you actually pass in a parameter, which is exactly the query argument.
Right.
You use something that's more semantic.
Right.
So you would just say, you know, art, and you'd pass in...
The record ID,
or you'd pass in whatever. And so there'd be something that was, like, just much easier to use. You wouldn't have to...
So he kind of, like, expanded on the API in a way.
Well, he turned it into something that was natural for a programming language.
Instead of...
Something that's natural for a URL, which is not natural when you're programming.
I see.
So there's a bunch of really nice Ruby examples of, like, Nokogiri is a gem I like that.
I see that it loads in Rails, and sometimes it takes a while.
It's for XML, and it kind of models the document really nicely.
Oh, I think I also used it one time in a gem to download Tumblr images. Like, you could download images off of somebody's Tumblr, and I ran it one time for someone's Tumblr, and, like, it put, like, 2 gigabytes of images on my hard drive. Because this person was a very prolific Tumblr. And I was like, wow. But that was amazing.
Nokogiri is great for screen scraping.
Yeah.
Basically, that's what you were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so...
So everybody got to work, wrote a bunch of apps, and... For, like... Saturday night and Sunday.
Yeah, people went until pretty late. I mean, we had food, obviously. That's always a draw. But, you know, people were there. And then there was... So let's talk about the kid. You really like the kid. They were the winner. They were the winner of the heck... No.
They were the people's choice.
They were the people's choice. So we had a bunch of awards.
So we had a huge range. So we had people who... We had one guy who did a phone interface, which you called a phone number. And it did speech to text. We had somebody who did a 3D game. One person did this amazing, like, complete implementation of an app that could be shipping right now.
Which one are you talking about?
Moshe's,
the Windows 8.
The Windows 8 app.
Looked great.
Beautiful. Yeah. It was fully using the API.
Yeah.
And it was this very nice horizontal thing that, you know, you could run on a
Apparently
surface.
This is like a window thing, is that they, like, Windows 8 or whatever.
So yeah, that's sort of side-scrolling, beautiful
fonts. That's interesting.
It's a very Windows 8-esque thing. But it was a nice implementation. You had a map with birthday and death date. It was sweet.
Yeah.
And then, but the one that I really loved was one that wasn't software at all.
Right.
So it was this concept by these kids. And they made this stop-motion photography thing that was, it was like a touch screen paper prototyped with video.
Right.
So the kids went into the Loose Center and they put their hand on the case.
Right.
And all of a sudden this
Something
image appeared,
yeah.
But it's a piece of paper on the glass.
Right.
And then they tap it, and more images appear, and then they slide their finger across, and it gets bigger.
It was impressive, because you had to do a lot of shots, right, to get that in.
And they've really conceptualized the software.
Right. They were like, I wonder if we could learn more about it, this artist. And it's like, you can! And he hits the wiki button, and then, like, Wikipedia, like, rolls in with the author. And they printed out that author's,
exactly.
You know, Wikipedia profile.
And it was like a Minority Report interface in paper.
Right. But, I think what everyone loved the most was the arrows, right?
Right. So then they could see related art that was on display.
Right.
And they tap it, and then these arrows appear on the ground, And the kids start chasing these paper arrows. They start
tracking them around. That was clever.
I thought it was a great example of how to show a concept without any software at all.
Right. And it makes a big difference being like, oh, you know, and you can get things from Wikipedia and you can be guided to, the, you know, like, that sounds so made up, you know, but, like, seeing arrows getting dragged by invisible, like, fish wire, that's like literally what they were doing, like, floss or something, it was so much more real, right? And this is your whole thing about, like, throwing out constraints or throwing out, like, suspending disbelief, right? We were talking about this.
So this is one weekend where you just imagine what might be possible. And we had 10 teams each imagining something completely different. So for one weekend, you're completely focused on doing this crazy thing that you would never otherwise try to do in a single weekend.
Right.
And then what's great, the thing about the hack is that you have complete permission to fake anything.
Right.
Like, whatever it takes to get to the demo.
Right.
And so if it's Sunday morning and it's not quite coming together, you just make up a different feature.
Right.
Or you're just like, that's going to be a picture.
Yeah.
We're going to make that not completely work.
Right. Because we did, like, 3 iterations of our app, right? So we had this idea. I think the core of the idea is that you could take a photo of an image and then get more information about it. Because, you know, people put art on display. And, well, first of all, in the Loose Center, they just don't have room to put, like, information about the art. Not a lot, anyway. But even in general, they'll often just be, like, a little bit of information about the general, like, work that we're looking at. But then each individual thing, it doesn't give you any info. But we have info about it. So, like, being able to snap a photo and, you know, that we know that there's some image recognition libraries out there that could allow us to, like, go back and... And then recognize the image, pull the image from Eden, and show us all the information that we know in a nice little screen. So that was our big idea, and we kind of mocked it up in 3 ways, right? So we had these images that Molly designed, and what Erie did was created, because everyone had to submit a video, right? And so we had to, Erie made a video where she kind of like talks us through the images. So that was like the first kind of experience into it. And then Molly may use this thing, and I'll include this in the notes for this podcast, file or SQ file or file SQ, you know, it's this pretty cool thing. And, what it does is it, allows you to link images together, right? This is the demo that we show you'd upload like 10 images and then you'd like box off areas where you could link them. And it was like HyperCard, like... Like, way to throwback.
Haven't we gotten anything as good as HyperCard for the web?
It's, well, what did you use HyperCard for?
I created a multimedia magazine on CD-ROM. That was my first HyperCard. Startup.
Yeah.
But that was back in the day.
I remember playing a little bit with HyperCard, and then the machines went away that had
It was
them.
Huge... Educational software thing.
Right. I liked hiding links in, like, periods. So, like, you couldn't know. And then, like, then you'd be like, watch this. Click. And then, like, load something else. So you could use this to highlight. And so we had that version of it. And then I built out at least one of the screens using actual data, right? Because images, you're still kind of, like, taking the best case scenario, right? Because a lot of the times... you pick a work where the title of the artwork is like fairly short and we know something about the artist and there's related media and there's a nice description. But then what happens is when you like do it for real with the real code and you run it a bunch of times and you get a bunch of images, you find out like, oh, sometimes the title is like, you know, 30 words, right? And it's like, it doesn't look good anymore. There's no description. And you're like, come on, I spent a bunch of time trying to come up with a way to like filter against things that had descriptions, and it just got really messy, and I like bailed and went reverted back to the old code. But, you know, so we had those three different, and, like, it got more real as it went on.
Right.
But you start with the dirty, you know, video prototype. So, and so you've done a couple hackathons, and you said this is, like, your favorite hackathon. Why, what makes for a good hackathon?
Well, I think that one of the things that was great about this hackathon, it had a nice breadth of people.
Mm.
There were people who, there were, I would say, I don't know, 60% coders. There was a good chunk of people writing code, but there were a lot of designers.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, at least one or two designers in every group. And there were people who were UX experts. And there were people who were kind of trading roles. There were, it seemed like that a lot of people willing to interact with each other too. It like wasn't super competitive like some of these hackathons. That it's not that they're you just get into the situation where everybody's focused on their team and they completely shut out everyone else.
Right, they don't want to talk to you anymore.
They don't want to talk to anybody else, and then you usually have people floating around and kind of helping everybody, like the sponsors,
right,
and mentors in the event. But the teams kind of, once you get into the hackathon part, they don't help each other.
Right.
Because they're completely focused on their own team and they're a little competitive.
Mm.
But this had this feeling, everybody's doing it because this is for our national treasures. This
right.
is for the good of the world.
And the prizes weren't that monetarily valuable.
Yes.
And so.
So this was, everybody was doing it to do it.
Right.
And so people helped each other. We had a little ideation session in the middle of it, and people from other teams came and ideated with the other team.
I like that, the brain stretch. Brain stretch. Not a brainstorm, brain stretch.
I really like that. I hadn't heard that term before.
Me neither. Yeah, it's good.
So yeah, we had a brain stretch in the middle of, what, Saturday afternoon, evening?
Yeah, Saturday, yeah.
The other thing is there was no, all the shades were down. We couldn't tell what time it was.
It was this total Las Vegas casino feeling. I don't know why. They just like
inside the art museum.
Right.
It sort of was timeless.
Right.
But anyhow, in the middle of the afternoon, evening, whenever it was, we had a brain stretch.
Yeah.
Where the Georgina talked about, or Bridget talked about.
Contributing to this, like.
So the challenge was how, what are the ways that we can contribute back to the museum?
We the public.
We the public. And they had a couple of different ways. And the idea was you had to draw, sketch out three.
Yeah, we had like 8 minutes. She like kept us on time. It was like 6 minutes for Georgina and Bridget to like talk about what had happened, and they talked about a couple of use cases where like people gave info about their uncle who was actually like the main person, you know, the main artist, or like the artist's like husband, and so they, you know, they could like fill in some biographical detail.
Right.
And there's some other one, I forget what the other way they could contribute
right.
was.
So there's these different very specific ways to contribute, and at the beginning of, we had 8 minutes or something.
Right.
To sketch out
ideas. It was
ideas.
Fast. It was tight.
And
was
at
struggling.
The beginning of it, I had no, I was like, okay, all I can think of is the most obvious, stupid thing.
Right.
But I was like, I'm going to draw this. And then, yeah, then I started to have more ideas. It was
right.
so fun.
It's funny how having an idea leads to having more ideas.
Yeah, I think that there's something about getting your idea out, like just writing some stuff down, then you get more ideas. I think that's part of the whole weekend, is it was all an ideation. It was about having ideas and thinking out of the box. And if we had just been tasked with, we have to build a kiosk and we will have N weeks to do it.
Right.
There is no way we would have done anything as interesting.
But why does that matter, right? Like, if at the end of the day, they're still going to build a kiosk that has real constraints and not, like, you know, magic happens and then, you know, arrows float around the floor. Why does doing something, why is this not just an exercise in, you know, like, for, like, a fun but pointless exercise?
Because I think that there are things that came out of it. Well, there are a number of ideas that are really easy to implement.
Okay.
that you just wouldn't have that idea because you'd been like, oh, we can't really add a game in because we don't have that much time for that. Mm-hmm. But then because we've been, you know, we have all of these ideas, we see that some of these games are really very simple.
Right.
And we also see that the games, the games that came out of this particular hackathon, kind of, what I really liked about them is they ended up augmenting the database with data from the users, a lot of them, not all of them.
Right.
But they were, one of the things that happens when you look through the digital collections is it's easy to kind of get bogged down and stuck where you don't see anything interesting after a while.
Yeah.
And just that, I want to call it the hot or not game, but it's like which piece of art battle, do you like
art
better?
Art battle, yeah.
It ends up surfacing this list of things that people like.
Right.
And those are just neat to go look at.
Yeah.
And they're much more fun than just paging through the collection.
Well, because it's an element of surprise, right? Like, you don't know what you're going to expect. And then there's this, we're creating meaning by saying, I like this one better. You know, what does like mean?
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. You know.
And then you have this curated list that's kind of funny because you look at it, you wonder.
And you could do that like every week, or you could be like, let's just do verses, you know, on holiday, you know, art, or like art by women, or like, you know, you can pick categories and you can do interesting things and slice at it.
So those are examples of things that are very small implementation tasks.
Mm-hmm.
But the coming up with the idea for them means that now they can pick, they can make editorial choices.
Whereas before they wouldn't have even picked.
Well, you have to do, when you're deciding to do a project and you haven't invented it yet, you have to say, oh, should we include a game?
Hmm.
And when you don't know what the game is. And it's crazy to to think like that, because yes, you should include a game if it's awesome and it doesn't mean you can't do anything else.
Right, but it's hard to know what that would be, how it would work.
Yeah, it's really hard to decide whether something's worth it when you don't know what it is yet.
Especially, it's like, because games need to be fun, and it's hard to, like, describe something and be like, that will be fun.
You know? And it's really, game development is really hard because you can't say, you know, like, okay, our ship criteria is that it's fun, and we're only going to take this many months to develop it.
Right.
And it will be fun.
Yeah. But, like, seeing a quick game in action, you're like, huh, this is, right, like, the you know, Georgina and Bridget were saying that, like, when they had free time, they were, like, on the game. You know, they, like, stare at this stuff every day, and they were, like, on their game.
And it's just, and it's great because, like, with Diego's game that, you know, he found the crying centaur.
Right.
The centaur baby.
Centaur baby. Wait, I don't remember centaur
the
baby.
The baby centaur.
Wait, what? How did that work?
It was just this random statue image.
Was he using it for something in
particular? Well, I decided that he had to use it for his 404 image.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It was just this funny thing that randomly came up in his game.
Right.
And then we're all entertained by it.
Yeah. Yeah, randomness is a really powerful thing. I've always been, like, kind of fascinated by it, too. Like, you know, the Rails app that I built was this, like, random reward generator. And, like, I made, like, this random search, right?
Well, something that I thought was really interesting, I saw this Stephanie Morgan video ages ago before I even met her.
Yeah.
And Stephanie Morgan is a very well-known, if you're in the game development world.
Ah, okay.
She's a well-known game developer.
Yeah.
And she gave this Creative Mornings Talk, which is a talk series in San Francisco, on gamification.
Mm-hmm.
And so she talked about the basic gamification thing where you kill monsters, so you get gold, so you can buy weapons, so you can kill more monsters.
Right.
Right? So this is the gamification thing. And she said that there are these studies that the chance of winning something is more motivating than when you know you're going to get it.
Oh, yeah. Variable reward. It's huge.
Right. Whereas if you are going to play 10 times and you know that every time you get one thing,
right,
one piece of gold every time, it's not as much fun.
It's a grind.
As if you have the chance of getting nothing.
Right. Because, but the other chance of getting like 10.
Yeah.
You know, or like even 3.
It's the difference between it being fun and being work.
Right.
Right? Because if you know what you're going to get out of it, then it's work. Because that's what we do when
that's
we work.
Interesting. But except that sometimes
what
work,
I do when I work.
Right. Because sometimes our work doesn't even pay out the way we want. And we're like, what? Or it pays out randomly and you're like, I don't know what's happening.
I think that's what we do this work.
Yeah, that's probably true. Is that once in a while your thing like totally blows up and you're like, wow.
That was me.
That was awesome. Fun. And well, what you want is then for that to happen like all the time. And then, but it can't, but then you're like, why? But
that's the challenge.
It creates the habit. It's also a habit. It's like a habit thing too. Like they've done that on rats where they like, they train rats to like push levers and then they'll do it. Like you get a reward every time you get a reward, like in a fixed time period, you'll get a reward. And then the reward after like a random number, a variable number of like lever pushes, is the quickest to stick. And it's the hardest to, like, extinguish. Like, after you stop giving them any rewards, they'll keep pushing for a really long time. Because, like, maybe I'm just going through a dry spell. Maybe I'm just going through, like, a really long, like, bat. And, but I'm going to get this thing at the end of it. And they're going to be so, like, because I was faithful. And I did it. You know, like, so, yeah, random rewards. In the art, it's just, like, some of the art's just, like, eh. And then you're like, whoa.
That's really neat. And I love that the art is its own reward.
Right. Art is its own reward.
But it's, you know, it's like the meme, the art meme thing that Georgina does.
Right.
Where they have pieces of art with these funny sayings
on
it.
Which is so amazing that she does this Tumblr. Like, yeah. Unbelievable.
Which, it's all about having people see our great nation's treasures.
With bold words attached to them that, you know, talk about current events in a snarky way. Only with that.
Some of these things were snarky in their day.
It's true. it's true. Yeah.
So.
That's okay. You know, I think what's interesting here is that they're going to go and use this stuff, right? They're going to go and use, like, do they have a plan for how they're going to use the ideas?
Well, I mean, the plan was that they were going to create an RFP.
Right. And they're still
going to
do that.
I mean, yeah, they're going to create new kiosks, but then I think, we haven't even talked about it, but I think there's an opportunity to just ship some of these apps.
Just ship it. Yeah.
And I think that's really neat.
Yeah.
That, you know, we have the chance to really just do quick, small, meaningful things.
Because Smithsonian doesn't do quick and small, usually.
Not usually, no.
Those two words don't really go together, plus the word Smithsonian.
No, they're
large, slow, massive,
significant,
yes,
momentous.
But I think it's the meaningful that makes it. It's like they're trying to be meaningful, and then the only way they know how to be meaningful is by being large, and like, and then large takes time.
Right. But
perfect. Also. So, yeah, and then I had this whole other thought, and now I've forgotten it.
Well, I was thrilled with how so many of the Smithsonian people came out for the presentations.
Right.
And people were genuinely excited. It's
like the people who built the API were there.
Yes.
Right? And
it always feels, I mean, whenever I've developed something and I see people use it, it's so rewarding.
Yeah.
And then I'm really excited to show these, to show the work that people did around to the Smithsonian leadership and to talk about the potential.
Do you think they're going to, like, do you really think people are going to care that, like, about these, like, little apps? Like, do you think people are going to be impressed, or do you think they're going to be like, oh, that's, like, this thing and whatever?
Maybe I can't get outside of my little bubble, but I can't imagine anybody not being super impressed by what happened this weekend.
Mm.
It was just so much thought put into the different ways that we could showcase this work
right.
in the digital world and in the physical spaces.
Right.
And I just think that this type of engagement with our citizens, you know, both in terms of the people who are at the hackathon and would like to continue to interact with the Smithsonian through its APIs to do work like this in the future, and the potential of how the public would interact with these apps.
I mean, it's no small task to ask 40 people to come in on a weekend and, like, sit in a dark room, dark-ish room.
Yeah, like, this is a dedication.
And type on their computers for no money, you know, but where it's something that other people will save money and get value out of, right? And this is the whole thing about that we've talked about, like, people can't... We have a hard time getting into other people's heads, right? Like, we had this meeting today where, you know, people keep talking, everyone, like, you know, people are always like, it's so hard to transcribe this document. I'm so amazed that these other volunteers have done it and are enjoying it. Or people come up to me and say, I'm really enjoying transcribing this thing. Or, and Sylvia, same thing with the botany specimens where we have these labels and volunteers are transcribing the labels. And she had these old volunteers and she's like, oh, I thought we would just, like, transfer the old volunteers. But we had, like, these new... I don't even know who these people are. It's like, surprise, surprise. Like,
people are into it.
They're people, and they're into it. And, you know, people who want to come and hack on an API. And I think part of the reason why we haven't opened the API and made it available to other developers outside of, like, something like this is because they're like, oh, but we're going to do all this work, and then who's really going to, like, do anything? Right.
Well, it's hard to really understand the significance of open APIs and open source until you experience it, because it just seems crazy.
That sounds like a cult. It sounds like it makes it sound like a cult. I have to, like, experience open APIs. Okay. Like, am I gonna be, you know, like, how much does this?
Well, it's like Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, before I used Twitter,
You're totally like,
and you're like, why Twitter? Would anybody do that? Like, now there's like kind of normal newsy things you can follow.
Yeah.
But when I started using Twitter, it was
a bunch of random people tweeting random things.
And I didn't have many people to follow, and I'm like, what am I supposed to say? And this seems really idiotic.
Mm-hmm.
And then my friend Ted Leung, he was on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I didn't know he was on Twitter. So I said, Ted, are you on Twitter? And he said, oh, yeah, absolutely.
He's so confident. He's like, and of course. Like,
really? Is it worthwhile? And he said, just try it for 3 weeks.
Mm. 3 weeks is a long time.
It is a long time. Well, if you're sitting by yourself coding in your home office.
Which is what you were doing?
Which is what I was doing at the time. There's not much that... It's rare. You know, when you're starting to do it, you're like, what do I tweet about? And then every once in a while I would, you know, tweet about something I'd read. And I'd be tweeting, I'm learning Git. And then I would tweet, you know, I'm still learning Git. And then a friend of mine tweeted back this amazing resource.
Right. And that feels magical.
It was...
That was your variable reward. You were like, nothing. Amazing resource.
Exactly.
Wow. I need to do more of those things. Because, like, what if... Someone else sent you an amazing
resource. And so now I tweet obsessively. Because I just might get this amazing thing.
They got you. Yes.
It's true.
That's good.
But that's another, like, it's something you have to experience to really understand.
Do you think then that showing videos and showing this presentation will, like, give that sense?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope it gives that inkling of the magic that can happen.
Yeah.
Because I think... We have a lot of people in this country.
That's what I've heard. Like,
and the Smithsonian has such amazing things.
Yeah.
And people and wisdom.
Yeah. There's a lot of room for this thing to work.
We need to make it available, more available. I mean, certainly available to people outside of DC, but not as available as it could be.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I think this was... So for those of you who are still listening at this point, holy crap, good job, guys. I'm amazed that you've lasted this long. But this was our first trial run at what we're hoping might be a pretty radical podcast, radical in the, like, rad, awesome sense, and not in the, like, you know, right wing or left wing or whatever wing it might be. But love to hear what you guys thought. We just kind of like winged it. You know, we just had an idea and we just went for it. And this one was about hackathons and APIs. So if you have thoughts, please tweet at us or email us. You probably will have, you know, probably have some way of contacting us if you're listening to this.
If you're listening to this, it means we've decided to post it
somewhere, and that thing probably on the internet. Okay. Thanks, guys. We'll wrap up, and I'll see you later.
All right. Good night.